Thanks very much. I've got a little bit of a case of the allergies. This early spring is killing me. I also find it a bit intimidating to follow our Irish friend here. My name is James Patrick Connell, so I'm one of those Irish guys who's never been to Ireland, and I'm going to disagree with my friend here about what made that share really special. It's all the fucking accent. I mean, he could be going blah, 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 but you do it with that Irish brogue, and it's just compelling as hell, you know. It's just so, yeah, my name is Jim, and I'm also an alcoholic as well as a grateful member of Al-Anon. I actually asked to speak about Al-Anon rather than AA because I feel like the biggest benefit I've gotten from this retreat over the years that I've been coming, it's about 4 years now, I think, with the Orcus Pod, is this mixture of having folks who, AA folks with Al-Anon folks and double winners at the same time. And the opening of the possibilities for how the two fellowships can really help both individuals, but it can also help lots of folks out there. And so I see as sort of my mission here is to talk about my story, but also talk about Al-Anon as a experience and how powerful it's been for me, both as an alcoholic, but also and primarily as a man. So at the heart of it, all Al-Anon for me is about, and that I've seen in my 4 or 5 years very intensively involved in this program, is that Al-Anon is about a love story. It is a love story. It's a story about relationships between people and people they love. It's a different story than AA. And as our first speaker, you know, mentioned, it's a, you know, AA for me too is a love affair between me and my booze and my alcohol. That's what it's about primarily. It affects other people like crazy. Affects the world around me every day. But Al-Anon is at its heart for me about, it's a love story. And so what I'm going to tell you today is a love story about my relationship with my wife and how addiction colored that relationship, moved that relationship, almost destroyed that relationship, and ultimately saved the relationship. That's the nature of the story. The other thing that's, I think, different about Al-Anon and AA is that Al-Anon is a clan, just like AA is, but Al-Anon has tribes within the clan. So it's a different love story when you're talking about a relationship between a husband and a wife being consumed by addiction than it is between a father and a son, a mother and a daughter, a friend and a friend. There are similarities for sure, just like there are powerful similarities between all AA's stories. But these stories, these tribes within Al-Anon, or whether it's between a person and their family of origin that was alcoholic, they're different stories. And they're all love stories, but they're different stories. And the way those get worked out and what recovery looks like is different. And it's respected within Al-Anon. And that's one of the things that I love about Al-Anon, is that people tend to gravitate toward each other, not just because they have a problem with a friend or family member has a problem with alcohol, but because of the tribe that they're in too. So one of my closest friends on this planet is sitting right here, Jimmy, and you know, we've only known each other for 4 years, but we're from the same tribe within Al-Anon. We came into Al-Anon at the same time when both of the people we loved the most in our lives were desperately, desperately, desperately in trouble, and we were too. And that bond is different than the kind of bonds that I have with my other brothers and sisters in Al-Anon who have a daughter or a son who's got a problem. Not that we don't have powerful relationships, but there's something different about it. So, again, I'm not supposed to give advice here, but my experience has been that finding somebody in your tribe is a really important thing in Al-Anon. Not just going to Al-Anon meetings, but finding somebody in your tribe who you really can sit down and dig deep with about what's going on. Okay, so my story. My love story began in 1975 in Denver, Colorado. I met my wife on the first day of graduate school. She impressed me immediately in three powerful ways. The first was that she was just smart as hell. The second was I could see that she was a kind person. And the third one was that she had great tits. And when I tell this story, I always say that that was in the order of importance. But my forcep told me that I can't lie. We had a passionate relationship right from the get-go, despite the fact that she was married. So once we got that guy out of the way, we ended up moving in together in graduate school in 1978, and spent the next almost 35 years together. The relationship started with me being in full raging alcoholism as a 25-year-old. I'd been drinking since I was 16. I guess you'd call me a high-functioning drunk, but I think the only reason I was high-functioning is because I was 25. If I'd been our age, I'd have been on the floor like when throwing up, and not that I didn't do that once in a while, but I didn't do it every day. She was not alcoholic, and at that point, she was from a fairly strict background in Tulsa, Oklahoma. She had an alcoholic uncle, but neither of her parents drank, and but she did use medication quite a bit, and I even noticed that. And I didn't know anything about addiction. I didn't claim addiction or anything like that. I claimed to know anything about it, but it just did seem like she was taking pills a lot for kind of everything. You know, whenever something went wrong, there was something in the medicine cabinet that would take care of it. You know, from Tylenol all the way up to painkillers or whatever it might be. But certainly did not see any kind of impact in terms of her behavior or anything like that, whereas I was, you know, all over the place. She tried to get me to stop drinking a number of times. Obviously, it didn't work. And but we did have a passionate love affair. We loved each other's minds. We loved each other's bodies. We loved being with each other. Everybody loved us. I mean, we were very popular in the sense of, you know, we were good together. And that persisted right through graduate school and then on to moving to our first jobs in Rochester, New York in 1981. Chris had gone to Western Washington University, so that's the Orcus connection. She had gone there in 73 to 75. So we ended up in Rochester, and she began to join me in my drug of choice. So it was a very social life. It was a very built around drinking. We were the people who had the parties all the time. We were the people who supplied the high-quality wine all the time. Drinking was the center of our world, and we made it the center of other people's world. And here's where, again, the paths diverged, which is that, like my father, I was a very high-functioning alcoholic. I was the guy who drove people home. That's what I did. I was the guy who drank more than everybody else, was more sober than everybody else, or apparently sober. Whereas when she drank, and probably, and I didn't know it at the time, probably because it was mixing with the medications, she would get a certain point, and then she would just go over the top. And she, as she called herself very affectionately, a droopy drunk, you know, she never acted out. She never ended up writhing on the floor or anything. She would just collapse. And it started to happen more frequently. And it started to happen in ways that were beginning to scare me. One time on vacation in Florida, we had been out drinking and having a good time and came back and went to bed. And I don't know why, but I woke up in the middle of the night because it felt very still next to me. I didn't feel like she was there. And it turned out that I sort of listened and I couldn't really hear her breathing. And I put my hand on her chest and it was just barely rising. And I decided for some odd reason to count how many times I felt her chest go up and down before I woke her up, and it was about 9 a minute. And it turns out that that's about 2 away from death. I called 911. They came and got her and took her to the hospital and pumped her stomach and told me that she was maybe an hour, if not minutes, away from death if I hadn't brought her in because of a combination of alcohol and the painkillers. So that's this is like 1992, okay? So this is 23 years ago. So that's when it sort of hit me that there might be an issue here that's different with my drinking and her use. And that's when the love story starts to turn into something other than a love story, where it became my responsibility to do something about this. And that's the beginning, really, of my Al-Anon story, which is the first part of this story up to this point, the first 10 years that we were together, was about two alcoholics being together and just carrying on with life, being drunks. And now it becomes something different because it involves me in the relationship to her of being the person who has to do something about her addiction. And that became the slide toward my bottom, which is that what would happen is that I would regulate myself. Who I was a function of how she was doing, right? So I stopped paying attention to my side of the street and started paying all attention and going over and being the cleanup person on her side of the street. And I lost a sense slowly over time. It took me another 10 years to really get to the point where I knew I needed to do something about it. But when I look back on it and thinking about my story, that's when I really knew that something was different here about our relationship other than the love story and the complexities and the problems that all relationships have. But in this case, it was about me fixing her and getting her to be better and taking on the responsibility of her being an addict. So 4 or 5 years later, car accident, near fatal car accident on her part when I was away at a conference. I get a phone call saying, your wife's in the hospital. And I said, what hospital is she at? And it was a drug treatment center. I mean, I had no clue. What had happened is that she had been in, she had gone to program after a serious incident, and one of her friends had been the one who was called, and she got called and came in and convinced Chris to actually not go to a physical, to a medical hospital, but go to a drug rehab. So that was the first rehab of four over the next 10 years. And what was happening to me, guys, was that this enmeshment, and again, one of the things I hope to do, and you know, what time I have left is to talk about some of these ideas that are in Al-Anon, that are these words that are just thrown out, and what they actually feel like. That enmeshment is one of the words that you hear a lot in Al-Anon. What it means to me is that I became so intertwined in her life and who she was that I was beginning to lose who I was in relation to that. I've already said, you know, my feelings go with her feelings, but now it started to get more and more intensified. I couldn't go away from the house without thinking about what she was doing. Remember, I've already seen her close to death three times, right? Three times with this, the breathing thing in Florida, the crash of the car. So it was always somewhere in my consciousness. And just like alcohol sort of pickles us and marinates us into different kinds of thinking, this same kind of worry and anxiety and concern also changes the way we think and the way we feel and the way we do our work, the way we talk to our friends. And it did for me too. And it was only after I got sober, which was, there was a certain point after one of her, it wasn't even relapse, I mean, she just continued to go and fall into these near-to-death situations, that I said, we had a deal. We had a deal for 2 years while she was going to meetings every day, that the deal was that I wouldn't drink in front of her. Now, there's a good deal, right? So, all right, and talk about enmeshment, right? A two-way street here. This is the addict, you know, the confessed addict, her, saying, I just can't stand it when you drink in front of me, but it's okay if you don't drink in front of me, and me saying, I'll sign up for that deal too. So talk about a love story going awry. So what I was doing is trying to find ways to get away from her so that I could drink, right? And thinking that I was helping her by not drinking in front of her. I mean, that's the kind of thinking that an Al-Anon and an addict will do. And we did that for a couple years, and that worked, as you can imagine, really well. So after a certain point, I got a call in L.A. This is actually 2005. I got a call in L.A., and I'm away again. And your wife has been found in the middle of the street of East Sound, Washington, on Orcas Island, face down, broken nose, a crack in the orbit of her face. And obviously, I need to come home. So I got on the plane, and the first thing, I was in first class because I couldn't get any other seat. and said, "Would you like?" It was 10 o'clock in the morning. He said, "Would you like something to drink?" I said, "Yeah, double Bloody Mary, please, and hold a tomato juice." And I, you know, just reflex. And it was one of my jokes, you know, funny guy, right? And then the person went off, and I didn't even think about it. I was hungover because I'd been drunk the night before. And they brought it back, and I said, and I looked at it, and I said, "I can't do this. I just can't do this. Because I don't know what I'm going to find when I get home. I don't know what I'm going to do about it. I don't even know who I am anymore. I can't do this. I've got to take this piece out of the equation." So for me, my bottom as an alcoholic was not a bottom of me going to the bottom. It was a bottom of me seeing what this had done to the person who I loved the most in the world and not being able to say to myself, "I'm okay if I continue drinking." I had to stop at that point. So I stopped without a program. I just stopped drinking at that point. And that was 9 years, and I've been sober for 9 years. So I got home. We go back into rehab again. And now the issues become, what is it that I do about this situation? Again, continuing to ask the question is, what do I do about her situation? What do I do about this? How do I get it fixed? How do I make it happen? And again, I'll go forward because the cycle, I think, is pretty clear. Again, I'm continuing to try to, so I take shorter trips. Instead of staying away 5 days on work, I only stay away 2 days. I sit by the telephone. I dread calling her on the phone from when I'm away because I'm going to have one of three reactions. If she picks up the phone and she's sober, I'm exhilarated. Oh, my God, she's fine. She's okay. If she doesn't answer the phone, I think she's dead. She's fallen down the stairs. She's broken her neck. She's gone. And so I'm in despair. If she answers and she's drunk, I'm angry. So those are my three options, right? So I get either exhilaration, depression and fear and anxiety, or resentment and anger. That was the nature of my life, you know, is that I would move between those things because I was completely, totally feeling with respect to what was happening to her and not what was happening to me. And I was who she was in terms of, I'd lost myself. That was my bottom. And that's when I got back that time, we went through one more situation like this, and I ended up saying to her, "I can't stay anymore." And she said, "Well, what do you mean?" I said, "I just can't do this anymore." And she said, "Well, just give me one more chance." And I said, "Okay." Because that's what I was looking for, right? I wanted a promise. I wanted a deal. I wanted a handshake. I wanted an agreement that I wasn't going to have to lose her either by me leaving or lose her by dying. And I got it. And guess what happened? The promise was broken. She went into rehab again. I said, "I'm not sure I'm going to be there when you get back." She said, "Oh, please be there." And I said, "Okay." She said, "You need to come pick me up at the rehab." This is about 10 days into the rehab. And she called me and she said, "You need to pick me up." And I said, "Well, what's going on?" And she said, "Well, you come down and I'll talk to you about it. And what they want you to do is come down and have a counseling session." I said, "Well, that sounds reasonable. I can see why they'd want to do that." So I go down, I drive down to Seattle, and I go to the center, and there's nobody. I thought it was a family counseling session. There was nobody in the room except me. And they brought her in, they brought her bag in, and they kicked her out. And I said, what's going on here? I said, "Why didn't you tell me they kicked you out?" And she said, "Well, I didn't think you'd come." And I said, "I probably wouldn't have, but we got in the car, we got to the ferry landing, we got back, and I dropped her off at the house and I left." And that's where I met you guys, all right? I came to Seattle in about 4 years ago or 5 years ago. I'd left Chris and I'd decided I needed to get into a program. And I went into Al-Anon. I went to 50 meetings in 30 days. I immersed myself. I met a lot of the folks that I've met in this room at those meetings. And I found a modicum of recovery. And the core of Al-Anon for me is this idea of detachment with love. And it's one of the most difficult things I've ever tried to do or I'm going to even try to explain. But I know what the opposite of it looks like more than I know what it looks like. The opposite of detachment is enmeshment. I know what that looks like. Being so involved and with someone else's life that you don't know what your own, where the difference is between who you are and who they are. And I know what avoidance looks like, running away. Detachment is not avoidance, right? Detachment is simply separating, but continuing to do that with love and affection for the other person. And it's a very, very challenging thing to do. And it's something that has been the key part of my recovery, is to try to figure out how to do that. And the detachment that occurred was that I had physically separated from my wife. She called it abandonment. I called it taking care of myself. And when I realized that I was right about it, and she could be right too, that was a major accomplishment. She felt abandoned. And I needed to understand that's the way she felt. But I was taking care of myself. Both of those can be true. And it being okay. I don't have to go over to her side and say, "You're right, dear, I'm abandoned. I can't do this. I've got to come back and take care of you." But I didn't need her to say, "It's okay for you to take care of me, myself." She could say that she was feeling abandoned. While I was in Seattle, she drove our car off the mountain where we live and totaled the car, crawled up about a 60-foot precipice on her hands and knees, and struggled to find her way to somebody's house, and somehow, some way, avoided getting taken into medical care, which I have no idea how she did that. And I didn't go home. I just I stayed in Seattle. I went to more meetings. I probably talked to somebody in this room. I think Paul talked to me that night. And she was okay. She called me and she said, I had an accident and this is what happened. And I didn't say, "Can I come? Do you need me to come home?" I said, "I'm glad you're okay." These are the steps in Al-Anon, you know, the coins. We don't give coins in Al-Anon typically, because we are facing these kind of crises every single day, right? It's not one day at a time for me in Al-Anon. It's a moment. Can I deal with the moments that are going to come that have nothing to do with my sobriety or lack of sobriety? It has to do with the other person. She is going to control when these moments occur, not me. So I got to be ready all the time. I may not be challenged in Al-Anon for days or weeks at a time, but am I going to be ready when the reality of the fact that this person is an addict, and addicts, as we all know very well, have one or two or three pathways they can go down, as was reminded to us. And she was headed down those paths. I have to be ready for her to be going down those paths and be ready myself to deal with it. Not to fix it, but to deal with it myself. So, where am I now? I'm alone. She passed away July of 2012. She had gotten out of Hazelden, 90 days out. She and I were in the best place that we had been ever, I think. And I've looked really hard at this with my sponsor to see if I'm making shit up, you know, trying to make it sound better than it was. But it really, he's told me too that we, and her sponsor has said that we were in a really good place. And she was a cancer sufferer, and had a breast replacement, and it didn't work. And she had to go back in and have it done again, which for anybody, any of the men here's wives have been through that, it's bad enough the first time. The second time, it's just horrible. And she dreaded it because she knew she'd have to take medication. And she did. And here's detachment with love again. And I'm going to tell you guys this because I hope it will help. I wasn't with her in the hospital for her last operation. I told her I couldn't see her on medication. I couldn't handle it to see her even slightly impaired. I'd been diagnosed with PTSD. I knew that if I was there, I would get triggered. And so I got a person to stay with her 24/7, you know, really good person. And I wasn't there. Two out of the last 3 days of her life, I wasn't with her. And so she got out of the, I picked her up at the hospital and she was fine. She had maintenance medication to take home, but she was fine. But I didn't have to see her coming out with the morphine and all of that stuff. And I took her home and we had dinner on the at our Mexican restaurant in Anacortes. So we had a burrito together, which she ate heartily. And we got home and looking forward to next day and went to bed and she didn't wake up. And that's not the end of the love story, because what's happened since then is that I've been able to think through this stuff and feel through this love story myself, to see her in recovery so many times, and to know the courage of a person. And this is where the transformation has come. What used to be my resentments for her failures at being able to lick this stuff became my respect and love, and that the fact that she kept trying. Four rehabs doesn't mean failure. Four rehabs means she hadn't given up. She kept trying and trying and trying. That's the kind of conversion that happened to me in Al-Anon, from resentment and discouragement and depression and anxiety to respect and love with detachment, being able to stand back from it. So as I shared last year, which was the first retreat after she passed, you know, my challenge now is to be by myself and be good with that. I miss her terribly, but I treasure my recovery in Al-Anon. I treasure my work in AA, and I treasure the opportunity to share. And now, you know, my qualifier is gone in Al-Anon. She's gone. But the meetings are just as rich for me. It's a matter of service as much as it is a matter of reinforcing my recovery. And it's a matter of having the opportunity to say that, that, you know, in Al-Anon, we are talking about a love story gone awry under the influence of alcohol and drugs, but one that can be righted, at least from our perspective, can be righted in the sense, if you can stand away from that love story, appreciate what it is, and not be the one who necessarily has to direct it and drive it and push it the way it needs to go. There's relief and recovery around the corner, and I'm standing here to witness that. Thank you. Thank you.